There's been a lot of news recently about Flint, Michigan. In 2014, Flint's emergency manager made the decision to switch the city from Detroit's water system to the Flint River. It was meant to be a cost-cutting measure that ended up having dire consequences for city residents.
Soon after that switch, residents began complaining that the water tasted strange, that the water seemed cloudy or discolored. As time progressed, doctors in the area started noticing that children coming in for tests had elevated levels of lead in their bloodstreams.
This story, which has dominated the news, has forced the resignation of top government officials in Michigan, and there have been calls for Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder to resign. He addressed the need for sweeping changes to his state's infrastructure in his State of the State address this week.
In addition to the issues in Flint, we have a statewide infrastructure challenge. Flint is not alone. Michigan is not unique. We have a national problem with our infrastructure. Michigan's infrastructure was ranked D by the American Society for Civil Engineers. Worse than the national ranking, which was a D+. We need to get this right in Michigan for the long term. We need to invest more and smarter in our infrastructure so we can avoid crises like this in the future.
As the governor pointed out, Flint and Michigan are not alone. People following the story, from engineers to environmental lawyers, have pointed out that as infrastructure continues to age in cities and other communities around the country, we could see similar issues cropping up. Joining us now to discuss the news out of Flint and what we can learn from it is Laura Bliss. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic's City Lab. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
So we've summed up what's been going on in Flint there. This is a big crisis. This is not a small thing to be swept under the rug. Do you see this opening people's eyes to the water that they take for granted?
Yeah, absolutely. It does flag some huge national issues with aging infrastructure, as you mentioned. Although I do think it's important to point out that we're seeing more and more evidence come out that the issue in Flint was really more a failure of government than it was infrastructure. It really had to do with a choice related to the water itself. But yeah, I mean, that said, like Flint, cities all over the country are watching their water infrastructure, reach the end of its lifetime. Most pipes in this country, or a huge portion of them, are over a century old.
Let's focus in on Flint a little bit and talk about where oversight might have gone wrong. Can you talk about the various levels of oversight that didn't flag this problem, didn't publicize it, didn't tackle it as early as they could have?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really remains to be seen, or at least certainty has really sort of yet to emerge here. Both the State Department of Environmental Quality, the Michigan Attorney General, and the federal EPA are all involved in investigations, sort of, asking that very question. But it does seem that there's really no level of government here that really can claim clean hands. This was a city issue, a state-level issue, especially given that, the city of Flint was under an emergency manager when this decision was made. Because of its financial issues, right, this is a cost-cutting measure that really went overboard.
Well, on a human level, talk about some of the consequences for the people who had been drinking this water, hopefully are not still drinking this water in Flint. What kind of things are we seeing, might we be seeing for years to come?
Yeah. The sort of really huge concern for many of the parents in Flint is the effects that lead poisoning can have on young children. Young children absorb lead at much higher rates than adults do. And what's particularly scary about that is that, the effects are kind of nebulous and don't always manifest until years down the line. Those effects include brain damage and neurological issues, lowered IQ, behavioral issues. And of course, it's also, demands mentioning that there's been this outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. 10 people have died, and many experts believe that that bacteria is also linked to the water supply.
Talking to Laura Bliss from the Atlantic City Lab about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and lessons we can learn here in Wisconsin and around the country. Laura, you start your most recent piece on Flint by talking about the value of water and how we think of water. Is it a public service? Is it a utility? Is it a commodity? How do you think we should be thinking of water to make sure we're paying the attention we need to make sure these things don't happen?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question that, you know, economists and utilities and all kinds of people grapple with. But I think the story of Flint is a really great example about why it's really important to think about water as a service that we're paying for rather than, you know, the commodity itself, if you will, of water. You know, we pay for water to be treated and conveyed, you know, to our taps safely. And you know, an adequate quantity. And that's really how it's priced. That's really what we're being charged for. You know, the vast majority of utilities really do charge for treatment and conveyance and not the molecules themselves. So that's what we're paying for, and that's really what needs, you know, what government and utilities need to be held accountable to. And that said, it's, water is also a human right. You know, that is the opinion of the UN. You know, I think it goes past the sort of question of convenience when you're talking about water as a human right. You know, this really taps into affordability issues to ensure that people have access to safe and adequate water.
Right, that's another part of the story in Flint. People were paying a lot of money for access to this water that turned out to be potentially hazardous.
Yeah, like between $100 and $200 a month, which is many, many times above the national average. Absolutely. And that gets into, you know, really what is, you know, partly at the root of this whole situation, which is, you know, Flint has seen just a massive population loss over the last couple of decades. And as a result, you know, there are fewer utility customers to spread this cost out to. And so individual ratepayers are really getting gouged. And you know, in a situation like this, it's just, you know, saying that it adds insult to injury is an understatement.
And this is something you could see happening in a lot of other places, either industrial cities where the industrial base is gone, population, like as you just mentioned, Flint is happening. You could see a rural area maybe with declining populations. We have counties like that in Wisconsin. It's a cost issue. Counties, municipalities, cities don't have the money to pay for this, and updating these systems is going to be really expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are many people in the water industry who sort of look at this as a you know, like the, that the they believe that the water industry should sort of act more like you know, energy and you know, that there should be sort of greater connectivity between different water systems in order to achieve, you know, greater economy of scale. But I think what you're also getting at is this question of aging infrastructure. You know, which is, again, a problem that, you know, virtually every city in the country faces. And yeah, well, again, I wouldn't want to conflate the problems in Flint with, you know, their infrastructure per se. It absolutely is part of the story and a big, big challenge for the whole nation.
I saw one analyst suggest that drinking water, in a way, has been a victim of its own success. It's there in a tap. We turn it on. We rely on it. We don't think about it until something scary, something horrible like this happens. Do you think at least one small upside is that we're going to stop taking this for granted and start confronting whether it's the infrastructure, whether it's the cost, the issues that face our drinking water?
I really hope so. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. You know, water systems in particular are designed to last for a very long time. You know, so when a lot of the pipes around the country were installed a century ago, it was kind of like, you know, dust our hands of that and sort of look away. And like you mentioned, it's totally underground, it's out of sight and out of mind. But yeah, you know, there's been reports that sort of peg the cost of replacing aging infrastructure around the U.S. at $1 trillion. And, that's a huge amount of money. But I think it's important to recognize, and Flint is sort of a reminder that those costs are only going to grow, you know, the longer we sort of put our heads in the sand about this.
We're talking about Flint's water crisis, what we could learn from it with Laura Bliss. She's been covering the story for CityLab.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think cities are investing enough in the pipes that deliver water to residents? Should we look at new technology to avoid water contamination? And are you worried about the water in your community? Let us know at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the Flint water crisis and how we could see similar issues crop up throughout the country as infrastructure gets older and less reliable.
Are you worried about the drinking water in your area? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should we be paying more attention to where our water is coming from, how it gets to us, and what it might encounter along the way? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page as we continue our conversation with Laura Bliss. She's a staff writer at CityLab. It's a project by The Atlantic. Go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Portage. Mike, hi.
Hello. I was calling because...
Go ahead, Mike.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, it's been decades that I've been reading about the writing on the wall about water shortages and that the real problem is water use. We have lawns that are the most farmed crop in America. We have sprinkler systems and just pools and everything that we use water for that if we charge for it, what it's worth relative to its rarity, 1% of 1% of water on the earth is drinkable, then that would solve the problem. But we don't charge for it, and we waste it. So I think we should...
Mike, thanks for the call. I think we just lost you there. But I think we got the gist, Laura, that if we think of water, I guess, more like a commodity, charge what it's worth, he says, charge more for it, it'll discourage waste. We'll use water more efficiently.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. On the other hand, affordability is a huge thing that water utilities also have to look at. Higher water rates might dissuade, wealthier water users from, using more water, although in some cases that's not even true. There were headlines out of California earlier, or last year, I should say, about, people spending close to $100,000 a year on their water. Like I was trying to say, it's still really important to factor in, how rates are impacting lower income water customers. There's still that sort of human rights piece that has to factor in.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Corey in Madison. Corey, hi.
Hi. I'm a public works engineer, and I just wanted to touch briefly on the cost of redoing this infrastructure. And we have to realize that a lot of our water as well as sewer lines are running underneath our municipal roads. And it's a little bit more than just a matter of replacing pipe. You're tearing up a road to get to that pipe. So that there's a much bigger cost involved than just updating one part of an infrastructure. It's a rather large expense, as well as our wells. Drilling new wells, capping off old wells. There's a lot to this.
And Corey, I wanted to ask, since you're a public works engineer, one criticism of what was done in Flint was the idea that they were looking to save money and made a decision quickly and maybe didn't think through all the variables that they should have. Is updating a water system something that we can do quickly or cheaply, or is this something that we really got to plan? This is like a years, maybe decades long project of planning.
I don't know. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, and I don't know exactly what went on in Flint. On the surface, that seems like a real knee-jerk reaction to something. I can't imagine even looking at doing something like that personally. But again, I don't know what the logistics were in Flint and why their motivation for doing that. But there is any time, and when you even when you backflush a water system, which is normal maintenance, and you the water turns a little discolored and people turn on their tap and it looks a little rusty, you know, this upsets everyone. And you walk a fine line with that, you know, tearing up somebody's water line for a summer project. I don't know why Flint did it, but they did.
Corey, thanks a lot for that call. And Laura, let's get into that. One problem people have said is this water from the Flint River plus the pipes that were in Flint, they weren't really compatible. They needed some kind of special treatment that they didn't get. So maybe a hasty job, not the planning that should or maybe even legally was required to happen?
Yeah, right. So the Flint River water was corrosive, like really, really high levels of salt. So right, that's what caused the lead to leach into the water. It seems that there were no anti-corrosive agents mixed into the water before it was delivered to the household, which is pretty common practice. And to my understanding, that was some kind of conflict between EPA standards and Michigan Department of Environmental Quality standards. Again, we're really still sort of waiting on clear answers as to why, you know, that particular decision was made.
We're talking about drinking water, Flint, Michigan, and beyond with Laura Bliss from City Lab. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jill on the line in Suamico. Jill, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a point that I didn't hear us talk about, and there are so many fingers to point. Why wasn't the emergency management thinking conservation of non-essential water uses like we've heard so much about in other states in the Southwest? Like, you know, I know people are taking more than 10-minute showers, all of these kinds of things. Why wasn't that done? Because I think there was price gouging was part of the, you know, economics of Michigan State. Why isn't there a statewide use of the Great Lakes that is shared into the internal landscape? You know what I mean?
Sure.
With so much better use of money.
Jill, thanks a lot for that call. And Laura, I want to take us to the Great Lakes. That's ultimately going to be the source of Flint's water, right? This Flint River project was a stopgap for a couple of years until they were hooked into this Lake Huron system. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And from what I understand, just reading the most recent sort of updates on that, that's still the city's plan, as far as I know, even sometime this year, according to the last thing I read, the city expects to be able to hook up to that new pipeline.
Jill, thanks for that call. So bad management, Jill is saying, and it seems like there's an issue of who does the buck stop with? Is it the local government, the emergency manager, the state environmental agency, the county, the EPA? What do you think a lesson should be as far as coordination, management? Who makes these decisions? Who sounds the alarms?
Yeah, you know, it's really impossible to say, you know, yes, this decision was made under an emergency manager. It's very possible that, you know, in the absence of that manager, that the same decision would have been made by, you know, city government and by the mayor and staff. So it's kind of hard to answer that question. But I do think that there's a really important lesson here. You know, Flint is like just a really dramatic and tragic example of, you know, a practice that's becoming increasingly common in cities all over the country. You know, between the beginning of the recession and, you know, 2013, something like 28 cities filed for bankruptcy. And, you know, all of the cities from Detroit to San Bernardino to Camden, you know, you can see stories of, you know, police departments, parks departments, libraries, you know, health, public services of all kinds just being really cut down to the bone. And people's lives, you know, suffer, you know, in all of those cases. In Flint, it's a really, really extreme, you know, visible example of that. So I think is a lesson, you know, for taxpayers and for legislators, sort of think about, you know, what is the line here that we draw when we're talking about making budget cuts in cities that are financially struggling? Because I think the story makes clear that there needs to be a line when it comes to such basic services.
Back to our callers now with Ivy on the line in Evansville. Ivy, hi.
From a broader perspective, you often hear politicians rail against regulations. The people, you know, if you have pesticides that pollute your water, you have pollutants, you can't, you know, for a person like myself, if my house were in Flint, I couldn't sell it. Who's going to want to buy it? Regulations protect us. They keep our water safe. But if you look at the economics of it, people who have polluted water as a source are in big trouble, you know, regular people. If you're wealthy, you can move or you can buy bottled water. The people in Flint can't move.
Ivy, thanks a lot for that call. And yeah, this is Flint, a city already known for economic hardship. This is going to make things even worse, make it more difficult to sell a house, probably to attract a business. So these environmental and safety issues, Ivy's saying, Laura, are an important economic issue, too. Are people talking that way when they talk about Flint?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just read an interview from the Flint, the current mayor of Flint, and then one of my colleagues at City Lab, and that was absolutely one of the concerns she's voicing. You know, Flint wants people to live there, of course, like any city. So yeah, it's going to be extreme. It's obviously an urgent issue that safe and adequate water supplies are restored. And you know, the city has already switched back to Detroit's water supply. But from there, it's really going to be an issue of restoring the citizens' trust in that water and in their local government, because that's really been shattered here. And that's not going to happen tomorrow. That's going to take some time.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Laura Bliss. She's a staff writer for the Atlantic Magazine's City Lab. She joined us to talk about the Flint water crisis and possible lessons for the rest of the nation.